All that we are doing in this moment is claiming what is rightfully ours.
That's
we
right.
are the workers. We are the workers. We do the work.
That's right. That's right.
And we deserve a government that works with and for us.
Welcome. It is Friday, June 25th, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Each week, I usually talk to, you know, that guy filled with so much middle-aged millennial angst that he had to take a three-week hiatus to Utah. You know, that guy, Sean Kitchen. About the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Today, however, it turns out that Sean has yet to return from his National Lampoon family vacation. So you're stuck with me. I was under the impression Sean was going to be back this week. Apparently, I am mistaken, or there was an extension of the trip. I don't know how it works, but Sean will be back sometime. You know, seemed like he had a great time out there, though, too, as well. We are streaming live at our YouTube channel. If you are watching us on YouTube now, or if you're listening to the podcast later, why don't you head on over to our YouTube channel, smash that subscribe button, make sure you like this stream, and hit that little bell so that you get notified every time that we go live. Today, like for example, we're starting a little bit early. since I didn't have to wait for Sean for the call, I thought I'd start a little bit early. I'm thinking, am I waiting around? I'm like, why am I waiting around? I'm not waiting for anybody today. Anyways. On today's show, you heard in the cold open today, India Walton, the socialist candidate for mayor in Buffalo, New York, won the Democratic primary on Tuesday, all but securing her election in the fall, given that Buffalo is a deeply, deeply blue city. Walton will become Buffalo's first female mayor and the first socialist to lead a major American city since the sewer socialists kind of ran Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the early 20th century. She beat Mayor Byron Brown, a four-term incumbent and close ally of Governor Andrew Cuomo, and ran a campaign focused on returning power to working people in New York State's second largest city. This is freaking huge. This is huge. And she has been amazing. She does not mince words. She's great. Biden signals that he'll back a new bipartisan infrastructure bill as long as Congress sends him a second bill at the same time that includes investments in our social infrastructure that was cut from the bipartisan agreement. That second bill will most likely need to run through the reconciliation process. And already, since word came out that Biden wants these two things tied together, it says, look, I'm not signing this bill, I'm not signing this bipartisan agreement unless we get this other stuff. Already, Senator Lindsey Graham is like, no way am I going to do this, despite the fact that he said he would support bipartisan efforts, right? Lindsey Graham right now is showing you who the Republican Party is, so let's not be delusional in thinking they're anyone but that. So we'll get into that. The Pacific Northwest is expected to be hit by an extreme heat wave this weekend. The National Weather Service is forecasting temperatures as high as 109 degrees. The heat wave comes as the region is already experiencing a significant drought and high fire risk. This is just one more argument for why climate change needs to be front and center of the infrastructure bill. Those very measures, by the way, that were cut from the bipartisan agreement. And Joseph McCarthy. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has signed a bill into law that will cut university funds if it finds that critical race theory or any other intellectual pursuit that is not hummed to the tune of a whitewashed version of American history is taught in classes. And the bill kind of encourages students to record their classes to rat out professors who deviate from the GOP-sanctioned speech. Free speech. Whatever, man. Whatever. Today, a little closer to home, huge Supreme Court decision stemming out of Pennsylvania, protecting the free speech in the case of PA high school cheerleader Brandi Levy. Now, this was a really interesting case. I'll talk a little bit about this a little bit later in the show. But basically, she was coming out basically saying she got pissed off. She went on Snapchat and says, F school, F cheerleading, F them all. Right. And then she was booted from the team. And they're like, what are you talking about? This was not like on school property. So the ACLU is calling this a huge victory for protection of rights of kind of off campus or, you know, speech that takes place off school grounds and that kind of thing. We shall see. And the PAGOP, yes, good PA Republicans, continue their assault on voting rights this week. Governor Wolf has now signaled that the bill that is being sent his way that will kind of, you know, increase voter ID, limit voting, all the thing we've been talking about on the show, that he'll go ahead and veto it, that it's basically a non-starter. We shall see what happens with this. And to remind you, we have 1 week left, like actually less than a week now. It's the 25th. 1 week left in public comments about PASHE consolidation plans. That ends on June 30th. So I'll have a link in the show notes for where you can go to kind of leave your comments or what you think about PASHE consolidation. And in today's last call, the International Space Station got some new solar panels this week, and that was pretty freaking cool. They actually had like live feeds where they were installing the solar panels. And, you know, I'll talk more about this in the last call, but it was like, you got this kind of window into the future of kind of like, you know, like in space construction. It was pretty wild. I have to say, it was fascinating to see these things get rolled out, all the spacewalks that took place and so on. And I don't know if anybody else was out last night, but last night was the strawberry supermoon. It was awesome. It was beautiful. It was huge. My daughter and I had gone out the night before, and we thought that was the full moon, but it turns out it was last night. But we went out again and kind of saw it last night, which is kind of cool. We call it the strawberry moon because it's like, you know, time when strawberries are kind of ripening, the end of that comes in, which is pretty cool. So that was kind of fun. DuckDuckGo. Have you heard of DuckDuckGo? Well, DuckDuckGo is a Chester County-based search engine. And they claim that they do not share or collect any private information. Well, they're making some moves to launch a full-scale desktop browser after some major kind of investments for some of these kind of like, you know, internet gurus or whatever it might be. Very, very interesting. I actually installed the extension on my browser to ensure that my privacy was protected. And it turns out the owner of the company has been one of these folks that has even testified in Congress about the need to break up big tech and protect privacy. So this is interesting, given in the light of our conversation with Cory Doctorow. So I'll tell you a little bit more about them. I think I'm going to reach out to some of those folks just to kind of, I'd love to have them on the show just to kind of talk about what they're trying to do and how this company is structured and all that, especially given the fact that they're based right here in PA in Chester County, Paoli, I believe. Oh, and Twitter was all abuzz this week as Sam Cedar, you know, the host of The Majority Report, he surprised that horrible right-wing YouTuber Steven Crowder on the H3P podcast with Ethan Klein. Crowder had been avoiding a debate with Cedar for years after ditching him at a Politicon a few years ago, 2018, I believe. And it was like literally like a public meltdown. And I have to admit, it was, you know, kind of a joy to watch, you know, kind of a little schadenfreude going on there. Maybe a little bit, I have to admit it. But it was just, it was something. And the fact that it got picked up by Newsweek, it got picked up by, I want to say like Forbes picked it up. I forget, some other kind of publications. This is, you know, good. You know, holding right-wing folks accountable, right, is always a nice thing to see. I want to remind you to tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org or tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And be sure to subscribe to the Rick Smith Show's daily podcast on iTunes, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. Go over to ricksmithshow.com and you'll get the news about what's the latest across all his platforms. And you must check out Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast if you have not already. I mean, come on. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast. What's your excuse if you're not listening to it? I don't know. All right, the first episode, you know, kind of dropped. I think they're on the 9th episode now. So the first episode is kind of like, you know, a couple months old. So you've had plenty of time to know what's going on there. And I'll warn you ahead of time, they're starting to introduce a little kind of specialized internal discourse right now. So, you know, you risk, if you don't get on the train now, you risk kind of like losing the thread of the discussion. So go. We talked a little about that in this last show. It's pretty fun. Anyways, the amazing PA women stirring the cauldron behind this podcast rocked a freaking house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Yes, yes. Sure. Make sure you follow them on Twitter at the Night Caucus and subscribe to their podcast wherever you get their podcast, wherever you get your podcast. And attention gamers, the Game Inn, two N's, the Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they got everything from retro N64s, latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, you name it. And look, this has been one heck of the year for kids in school. And if they came out of this year with any A's, well, boom, bring that report card over, show them, and they get a discount. Pretty awesome. You want to follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn with two N's. Look them up on their Facebook page. And if you got a question about anything, something looking for, it's hard to get, just drop them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com, thegameinpa@gmail.com. Special shout out, as always, goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at songadayman with two N's, at songadayman on Twitter. Look, if we want a progressive future, folks, we need progressive media. I don't know how else to say it. And this is a theme that keeps on coming back in some of the interviews that I do with folks. We talked to Candida Kenner last week. We've talked to Cory Doctorow. We've talked to, I mean, you know, we had, you know, folks on the show, like with Shanna Danielson. We had, you know, she's been on the show a couple times now. Angela Valvano was on as a guest host last week. We're also trying to do the independent media. And this is a theme that keeps on coming up in a lot of discussions that I've been having on Out to Coop Live about the need, right, to have a homegrown progressive media, right? A movement-based media, right? That's what we need to do. And we need, like, instead of, you know, maybe those would be some angel investors that will drop us chunks of change like they do on the right wing, but that's usually not the case. The only way that we're securing movement-based media, progressive media, independent media, right, is for you the listener, for you the, in the movement, to help support this show and help support others in the independent media realm. So look, you can help support Raging Chicken by becoming a patron of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress, right? We're here for the fight, but we need you to help support us back, right? Become a patron for the price of a good beer once a month. Help keep the media in the movement in the media. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. today. Well, I think I do want to start off the show a little bit today with some programming notes, because as you can see, Sean is not here, as I said at the top of the show. He's still off in the middle of the country somewhere. Last time I saw his pictures, he seemed lost in Utah, or kind of eating extraordinarily large plates of food, which had me a little bit concerned at one point. But I digress. So, but this week's coming up. My family and I are going on vacation for a couple of weeks. So this show will also not be here for the next 2 weeks in its normal format. But I wanted to let you know a little bit about what I've got in store for folks. I didn't want to just kind of leave our feeds blank for 2 weeks. For those folks who've been dedicated to the show, who've been supporting us for years, I want to kind of give you some special treats for the next couple of weeks. So let me just kind of walk you through a little bit about what we've got coming up in terms of our programming. So on Monday, I pre-recorded a show last week. So we have an Out to Coop Live this coming Monday. The show's probably, instead of waiting till 7 o'clock at night, the show is probably going to drop at, you know, kind of in the morning on Monday. It'll be there. And it was an interview I did with Dana Morrison and Eleni Shermer. They have wrote this great piece. They're part of a kind of a collaborative of folks that wrote this great piece about university debt, right? The other debt, like not just student debt, while that's huge, of course, but the debt that universities have incurred by taking on, you know, all these loans, right? By taking on, you know, yeah, I mean, all sorts of loans for big buildings or whatever it might be. And as you'll see in that discussion, that's kind of come out of this twofold, you know, dynamic, if you will. On the one hand, as we've talked a lot about on the show, you've had the defunding of public higher education in particular over the course of, you know, the last 40 years. It's been that gradual kind of defunding where more and more the burden of higher education is being forced on students and their parents. Right. So a divestment from the public interest in education. And on the other hand, it has to do with a whole bunch of kind of market based schemes being used by university presidents to try to kind of like, you know, market their university and becoming more attractive to students. And that's usually kind of taken the form of building these kind of like extravagant, you know, dorms, you know, climbing walls and all sorts of, you know, the beautification of our campus. I remember at Kutztown University when they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on new signage, right? New signage. And, you know, getting new signs for your university and upgrading, making them look nice is not necessarily, I'm not necessarily saying that's a wrong thing by itself, right? But when you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on new signs, at the same time that you're telling students and faculty and staff that you're in a budget crisis, it's kind of weird. When you're putting a new entranceway on the administration building, so there's a new sitting room in the area and that lets more light in at the same time that you're telling faculty, staff, and students and the public and legislators that, you know, you're in crisis, that you have no money. Well, like, it's a little weird, right? And, you know, it turns out that these universities were taking out lots of bonds or loans, right? To kind of, in order to build this stuff. And they had all these weird financing schemes for which to kind of deal with it. And that incurred a bunch of debt, right? So now all this stuff is coming to crisis. It is coming to a crisis after the pandemic, right? And a lot of folks are using the pandemic, as you've heard, you might have Brian Bailey on the show and stuff. We've talked about this. They're using the pandemic as a cover in order to accomplish significant cuts and reorganization of faculty, staff. You know, in Pashi's case, we see the consolidation of universities, a whole bunch of stuff like this. So anyways, Dana and Eleni, we're going to come on Monday, and they're going to be talking about that. It's a pre-recorded show, but it will be released on Monday. It's a great conversation. Talk a little about what we can do in order to kind of, you know, politically organize, right? So that's on Monday. Next Friday, given the fact that the comment period ends with Pashi about the consolidation on, what is it, on the 30th, which then I believe is Wednesday, and there's been a dynamic in which I've been extraordinarily, like, frustrated about, if you heard me on the show talk about this, where people don't actually kind of remember the history here, right? About what got us in this crisis. Nobody wants to talk about the, you know, the defunding of higher education. And nobody wants to talk about this, like, the bonding that the universities did and the, you know, what looks to me, I mean, look, I'm not an expert, but looks to me like deceptive budgeting practices or accounting practices, if not fraudulent ones, right? So I thought we'd try to do, while I was away, to give you a couple kind of reminders of that. So next Friday, I'm going to, as part of the podcast, I'm basically going to play a documentary, a mini documentary I did with Colleen Bradley. Colleen Bradley is was the vice president of administration and finance at Westchester University. And Colleen happened to be, you know, she's on the inside. She was the person who had access to all the information. And she blew the whistle on Westchester University's administrators and Pashi administrators, basically encouraging her to use deceptive accounting practices, right? What she got concerned about is that to her, it looked like fraud, right? So she had a case that basically she blew the whistle and she kind of brought it into more and more public spheres, and then she was fired because of it, right? That led to a series of court cases about kind of her trying to claim whistleblower protection. And because of the peculiarity, I could never say that word, of the way that the court, the initial appeals court considered her case, her claims that her case has never made it before a jury, right? What these different courts have ruled, and then the Supreme Court refused to hear it. What these courts have ruled is that because Colleen didn't go immediately to the press, right? That she didn't blow the whistle publicly under the press, but because she went to public forums and more public forums within her university, they said that was part of her job description, and therefore she could not get whistleblower status. So the merits of her case have never been before the court, which is why people can't say, look, there's been fraud. And which is why state legislators and the chancellor of the state system of higher education, this one and the previous ones, could just ignore what they had done. So she contacted me back in 2018 and she said, you know, hey, look, I know you've covered this story. And she reached out to me. I had never met her before. She's like, I know you covered this story. I want to see if we could do, and there's something way you could help. And so I did this mini documentary. I had her on the podcast. And interviewed her lawyers and things like this, and put together this mini documentary and kind of the podcast. So for next week, we're going to replay that Colleen Bradley story. And I'm going to have a link in the show notes for next week that will direct you to the YouTube video, because the YouTube video is a little bit different because it has some kind of, you know, some graphics and that kind of thing. And I'm only going to play the first part, which is Colleen Bradley's story. The second one, after I rewatched it with her lawyers, was really geared about that kind of gearing up to the Supreme Court case. So it's you know, it would need to be kind of updated to where we are now, what the consequences are. But I will link it there so you can watch that too as well. So that'll be next Friday. It'll be the Colleen Bradley story, and her story and her experiences. And it's really, when I was rewatching this in preparation for the show, I found it was devastating then. And I feel it all over again. Because she was incredibly brave and just a woman who's standing up for what was right. And she was fired for it, and nobody ever paid the price for it. And now we're all paying the price. Right? So that'll be next Friday. The following Monday, Out to Coop Live, I think we may be off for that one. I think I had something that I was going to... Oh, no, I know what I'm doing. I'm sorry. My bad. So the following week, that would be the 5th. So the day after, you know, day we celebrate 4th of July. But the 5th of July... you're going to hear Raging Chicken's first ever interview, the one we conducted back in November of 2011. We had just gotten off the ground and we landed an interview with Noam Chomsky. So we talked to him about Occupy. We talked to him about kind of social movements and organizing. It was a great conversation. I'll warn you ahead of time now. You'll hear it again before the show. The audio quality is not great. We were in this kind of very echoey room. We didn't have the proper recording equipment. We thought we did, but then when we got there, we didn't have what we were supposed to have. So it's a little echoey. I try to do some sound manipulation and that kind of stuff to try to bring his voice out a little bit more and bring up the level. So it's better than it was originally. But I'm going to have that interview, that original interview with Noam Chomsky from the archives. And then the following Friday, so 2 weeks from today, I'm going to have the podcast interview that I did with Colleen Bradley and her lawyer, Dan Kearney. So that you get to hear it kind of fleshed out in a little bit of a different form. You get to hear a little bit of her story, but you hit more of the legal case and why this is so significant when it comes to whistleblower politics. So pretty packed. And if that's not all, if you've watched the Wednesday show this week with Cyril Mikulenko, you've already said this, but Cyril is going to be taking over the reins of the Wednesday show. Showed him a little bit about the recording and that kind of stuff. So he's got a couple of interviews that he's planning to do to launch those on this coming Wednesday and the following Wednesday. So you should have fresh content there too as well. So there you have it, and this is, I want to say just thank you again to everyone who supports this show, everyone who's stood up, from the beginning back in 2011, when we didn't even have a podcast, we were strictly kind of an online news place and writing space, to those, members who just joined this past month, right? Your support of the show has made all this stuff possible. And, you know, it looks like a really bright time if we can continue building on this and continue to get members. The other thing I want to thank everybody for is, even if you're, you know, you haven't been a contributor to the show, the one thing you can do, you can help out, is just, you know, tweet stuff out, share it with your friends, share it in your social networks. Every time we have a show, share it out and plug the show. That helps so much, I can't even tell you. I've been doing a lot of thought. I'm getting way off topic here, I know, but I've been doing a lot of thought about one of the things you find in doing this work, right, is that it doesn't necessarily take off in the way that you think it should. Right. Or the way I think it should, at least. Right. And some of that has to do with the way that the algorithms work. I mean, we had pretty good kind of, you know, numbers and kind of, you know, followers and all this kind of stuff back in the day. And this is before the podcast, when Facebook changed its algorithm. Right. And really, like, effed us up, right? Really kind of, we had to kind of remake stuff to get even people to find it. They wasn't showing up in their feeds anymore. We get complaints from people. Why isn't it showing up in my feed? And like, that's Facebook, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But you know what? I don't think we ever made this decision consciously. But, you know, on this show, we've really decided not to just go out and chase the algorithm. There's a lot of people that are in, you know, in the YouTube world, the podcasting world, and that's what they were trying to do. They're trying to just create outrage in order to, you know, get the numbers up. And what we've been trying to do is slowly and methodically kind of build out a kind of independent media space. And, so, you know, and I feel good about that. Like I can look at what we do and can say, look, we've never made a choice on the show that just been about kind of getting hits, right? It's been about thinking about what kind of voices we want to bring on here. What, you know, what would be kind of a cool thing to share with our audience? Who do we want to collaborate with as a way of doing this? And so having some little contribution to this space. And, you know, hopefully, you know, as my friend Rick Smith always said, you know, you stay in the room long enough, somebody will notice. And let's hope, right? You certainly all have. And thank you again. So on today's show, we might take one break today and I'll kind of get through with it, but tons of stuff is going on. And I just want to highlight a couple things for today and kind of maybe tie it all together. What just happened in Buffalo, New York, for example, was pretty astounding, right? Now, I'm from New York State, right? I'm not from New York City, right? I grew up in Utica, New York. Right. My mother's side of the family is from Buffalo, Niagara Falls, right? All that right out where this is going on, right? So I know that area very well. Right. My dad's family's from kind of Schenectady, right, area. Schenectady, Troy, Rotterdam, all out in there. Right. So I grew up in upstate New York. I grew up in Utica. I lived for about 8+ years in Syracuse. Right. Spent time in Rochester, you know, that kind of thing before I kind of moved off to, you know, Ohio and D.C. and things like that. Right. So this is kind of like home for me. And, it, you know, Buffalo is New York State's second largest city. Right. So, I mean, obviously, New York City dominates, but Buffalo is a huge city. If you've ever been out there, there's chemical plants that are out there. It used to be a huge industrial town. Annie DeFranco came from there, for example, you know, and it's got a really interesting history. Not just that it gets buried under like feet and feet of snow every year for lake effect snow, because it's right on the lake there. But it's been ravaged by, you know, it's been ravaged by, you know, environmental destruction. Love Canal, if you ever remember, is like this whole area. People that were, you know, getting cancer and dying because of pollutants that were leaked into the water. That happened just outside Buffalo, right? That Love Canal, Tonawanda. I don't know if it was Tonawanda is the town where it happened or it got near there. And it is a solidly working class town. Right. And the people there have been suffering. And, you know, the current mayor, right, his name is Byron Brown. You know, he's buddy buddies with Andrew Cuomo. Right. And there's been a whole bunch of deals that have been passed recently, which I think is what helped India Walton in part. Right. Was, you know, that was you know, basically found to be extraordinarily corrupt, right? There was, you know, looks like, you know, pay to play stuff and that kind of thing. And most recently there was I forget the numbers on it, but there was a Tesla plant, right, that was slated to go up, and there was like millions of dollars that were kind of given over to Tesla for this plant. Nothing's ever happened with it, right? And, you know, and I think that really outraged people because, you know, people were hurting in that area. You know, this is another area that was ravaged by NAFTA, right? Ravaged by kind of like, you know, global capitalists who decided to pull away from Buffalo and kind of go elsewhere, right? You know, as she put it here, and I love this, I'm just going to read this piece. This is from the New Republic. This article called "Can the Socialist Mayor Rise Again?" by Danielle Chalakian. I'm going to butcher her last name. I'm sorry. But here it is. So it's in the tableau of New York State politics. Buffalo evokes the Buffalo Billion, a markedly top-down economic development deal that has become shorthand for political corruption. Governor Andrew Cuomo's closest friend and aide, Joe Percoco, is currently in federal prison because of involvement with it. Walton is running for mayor, and this is before the election. Okay, so this is a few days before the election was held. The primary, I should say. Walton, India Walton, is running for mayor as a socialist and has faith that will translate for people, that it will translate for people. Quote, "We have socialism for Tesla," she says, one of the beneficiaries of the Buffalo Billion deal, quote, "and rugged individualism for everyone else. I want to flip the paradigm." Walton speaks about the needs of a city she knows well. She had her first child when she was 14. Her mom wasn't happy about that, so Walton moved out and lived in a home for young mothers just outside Buffalo in Lackawanna, raising a baby born with a painful chronic illness while still a child herself. She tried hard to finish high school, only leaving work when she had her twins at 19. They were born premature and teeny tiny, she tells me, barely a pound and a half each, one with the central line in his chest and the other on oxygen. Walton didn't have a car, so she rode the bus through Buffalo with her babies to all those follow-up appointments. Looking back, she balances gratitude to a health system that saved their lives with a clear-eyed remembrance of how that system was stacked against someone like her. "I didn't like the way my family was treated when we were in the NICU," she tells me. "I felt dismissed a lot." Right? And it goes on. When she came out, you heard her kind of acceptance speech, or her victory speech, I'd say, right at the beginning of today's cold open. She comes out solidly. She was asked after the election, you know, "So, you know, now that you won, you're most likely going to be the mayor," right? Because, I mean, Buffalo is deeply blue, right? It's a deeply Democratic city. It's kind of like, you know, in Philadelphia, whoever wins the Democratic primary is going to win the mayoral election. I want to say something about that in a second too, but so. She was asked afterwards, right? You know, again, as like local reporters trying to pick up on the kind of, you know, the discourse of national controversy. "So you said you're not a democratic socialist. You're like, you know, how would you like to respond to that?" Right? She goes, "Do you consider yourself a socialist?" And she looks right at the camera. She says, "Oh yes, I'm a socialist." I can't even tell you how good that felt. I was like, no beat around the bush. No kind of mincing words, no kind of, "Well, it depends what you mean by..." No. Boom. She goes, "I am here to empower working people." I just can't get over it. So I'll let you know, all know now, is that one of the things that is on my agenda for today, now I'm going to be away for 2 weeks, but I'm going to reach out to her campaign. I'm going to see if we can get her on the show. Because I have often thought that left movements, right, we have been hamstrung for 40 years by a series of defeats, right? And we could go all the way back to Reagan, and I'm not going to rehash that history for you today, right? We can all go all the way back there. But we have now seen some historic wins, right? We've seen the Squad. Right here in Pennsylvania, we saw the own version of our squad, first with Summer Lee, Sarah Enamorato, Elizabeth Fiedler, right? Now we got Nikhil Saval, Rick Kajewski, right? We've got, I mean, I could just go on and on, right? But you get the idea, right? We've had some major victories, right? And it's that moment where instead of remaining insular in terms of the state, we need to be like following, like looking for inspiration elsewhere too. Right. I've begun to think about how important it is. You're going to hear this in that Chomsky interview in a couple of weeks when, you know, he talks about the importance of having victories. Right. And unabashed victories. This is why when she looked at the camera and said, yeah, I'm a socialist. Yes. This is what I believe. It can help us find our language and our discourse and not be stuck behind, I don't know, this perceived and not so perceived discipline that has been wrought on all of us throughout this kind of like decades of neoliberalism, right? And I think that's all the more important when we're kind of thinking about the next generation to come. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this, you know, because, you know, I was waiting for her to, you know, to couch her words, not because anything bad about her, because it's just like, that's what I grew up in too, right? I mean, you know, knowing that there's going to be backlash, you know, and to hear her say that so forthrightly was just, it felt glorious. And to know that in my like neck of the woods, so to speak, that I grew up in, that I know very well, to see that happening there is just amazing. And I hope that gives inspiration right across the, you know, the New York State Thruway corridor. That's the I-90 corridor that runs from Buffalo all the way to Albany. You know, if you look at this, you got Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Utica, Amsterdam, Schenectady, Albany, you know, right across that, right across the New York State Thruway there. Imagine, right, that if that organizing follows that trend, it'd be great. So here's to it. So that's just huge. I'm absolutely thrilled to see that happening. We're going to follow more. We're going to reach out to her campaign. We'll see if we can get her or at least some people from her campaign on the show. If we can't get her, maybe we'll reach out to the Buffalo DSA, who had a huge role in helping get her elected. And so we shall see. Okay. The second thing I want to talk about today, and this kind of links into the next couple of stories. Sorry about the phone ringing there, but Biden, as you've probably heard already, there's this new bipartisan infrastructure bill that is going through Congress right now. And Biden has said that he'll sign it. It's getting all this fanfare in the media, you know, okay, yes, it's a smaller one, you know, and again, all the focus is on how it's going to get paid for and all that, without actually really focusing on what's in it, right, or what's left out of it, right? Now, I shouldn't say it as kind of as black and white as that. Because, you know, there has been some decent reporting that has been looking at some of this stuff about what has been, what's not in there, and what is in there. I want to kind of pull this up, see if I can find this real quick. It's coming out. Nope. Let's just say it like this. So, you know, this new one, this, you know, Biden had a kind of multi-trillion-dollar kind of bill. The one that here, so I'll reach this is the headlines here from the New York Times. A deal reached Thursday between President Biden and a bipartisan group of senators for $579 billion in new spending to repair the nation's roads, rails, and bridges does relatively little to fight climate change, an issue that the president has called an existential threat. The deal does provide funding for public transit, passenger and freight rail, electric buses, and charging stations for electric vehicles, all designed to try to reduce pollution from passenger vehicles and trucks. And it includes $47 billion to help communities become more resilient to disasters and severe weather caused by a warming planet. Still, it contains few of the ambitious ideas that Biden initially proposed to cut fossil fuel pollution that is driving climate change. So that was one of the best pieces that I think it came out that kind of framed what's going on. So one of the things that I do appreciate of this, so you see a lot of reports coming out, you know, $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, and it sounds like a big thing. But this report here from the New York Times by Coral Davenport and Lisa Friedman, they correctly, you know, point to the fact that it's 579 $6 billion in new spending. The rest of it is stuff that's already there. It's money that's already out there, right? So you're talking about half of the bill, this $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, about half of that is money that is already being spent, right? The other half is what's new. So when you look at Biden's original plan, which is upwards of $2, $3 trillion, right, in the plan, this is like pittance, right? And I have to say, I think that the Biden administration seems to be aware of that. Now, what they're planning to do here is a little bit of a political jujitsu. And let's be clear, the Democrats have not exactly been good about this, and they've not been very skilled at this. And sometimes I worry that Democrats think that, you know, they're being a little bit too clever by half, right? I think like, okay, here's how we're going to do this. So the plan, as it's kind of been begun to emerge, and Biden has come out and says that, you know, he supports what's in this bill. However, he will not sign it unless Congress sends him a second bill containing those more ambitious parts, right, about the social infrastructure, human infrastructure, and climate-based stuff, right? Because remember, what the original infrastructure plan, not only did it kind of do roads and bridges and stuff, which is absolutely needed, right? Just we saw in Miami yesterday where a building fell down. A building just fell down. There wasn't an earthquake, right? There wasn't some kind of like tornado. It just fell down in the middle of the night. Right. And some reporters that are from Miami have been saying, you know, look, yeah, this is something that happens in third world countries. It's happening in our country. Yeah, damn straight. Because we have neglected our infrastructure and we've allowed for this deregulatory environment around building codes and all this stuff. And I would not be surprised if we find out, because this is something that was kind of close to the water. I would not be surprised if we start to find out that there's been some inundation of water, right, as sea levels slowly begin to rise, that has contributed to the collapse of this building. I might be completely wrong about that, but I would not be surprised if that was the case. Anywho, so what we see happening here in the infrastructure bill is going to be really important. So Biden basically says, okay, yes, I'll support that, but you got to send me this other thing. And I think it's pretty clear. I don't think there's anybody who's seeing with clear eyes thinks that the bill containing all this other stuff is going to get the support of 10 Republicans. 10 Republicans look at something like, you know, childcare, guaranteed childcare, and the expansion of education, and making sure that we have kind of adequate nursing home staffing, and, you know, all this other stuff that was in that infrastructure bill that took that broad idea about infrastructure as being our human infrastructure, right? We're not going to get 10 Republicans for that, right? So the real target for that second one is to say to Joe Manchin and to Kristen Sinema, all right, you want me to support this bipartisan stuff that you got going on? That's fine. But you need to be on board for reconciliation. You need to pledge to me that you are going to support that reconciliation bill after Republicans say they won't vote for it. Right? Because remember, in reconciliation, and this is all budgetary stuff, in reconciliation, you need a 50 vote majority as long as Democrats stay in the presidency, because Vice President Kamala Harris will break the tie, right? So that's kind of where we are. I don't know if that's going to work. I don't. Because I don't trust Joe Manchin. I don't trust Kristen Sinema for sure. And I certainly don't trust these Republicans. Right. So already Senator Lindsey Graham said, I'm all for an infrastructure bill, a real infrastructure bill that will come out and have bipartisan support. He lent himself behind even the terms that they went into, said this is what was a framework. He said he'd support it. But as soon as it leaked out that, no, guess what, everybody? Guess what? That Biden wants that other stuff, too. Like classic Lindsey Graham throws a hissy fit. Right. So let me just read you a little bit. This is from this Microsoft news site, but yeah, this is good. They're taking it from Politico, but whatever. So this is Graham. He says, quote, if he's going to tie them together, he can forget it, said Graham. I'm not doing that. That's extortion. I'm not going to do that. The Dems are being told they can't get your bipartisan work product passed unless you sign on to what's left, to what the left wants. And I'm not playing that game. Right? There he is. And then this is what this is, the, you know, this is the kind of guy he is. Graham told Politico that the five Republican senators who negotiated with Biden on Thursday had not informed him about the plan to link the infrastructure bill and a reconciliation bill and said that those Republicans may not have known about it. Right. Quote, most Republicans could not have known that, Graham said. There's no way. You look like a effing idiot now. I don't mind that bipartisanship, but I'm not going to do a suicide mission. This is what he says. Right. So, look. Does that surprise you? Shouldn't. Ms. Lindsey Graham. This is today's Republican Party. Right. All they needed is some little excuse to bolt. And that's what they're going to do. And so now, yes, they've got five Republicans on this bipartisan, quote unquote, bipartisan agreement. Right. But Lindsey Graham is signaling to the rest of the caucus, the rest of the Senate Republicans, we don't give them the additional five because remember, they need 10. So Lindsey Graham is pulling it off. He was the 11th. Now it's down to the exact 10. And now the pressure is going to go on those remaining folks to not vote for the infrastructure bill and kill it. And because Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema are all out there defending the filibuster, right? That means even this infrastructure bill may go down. So this is kind of where we're at. Okay. Now, this is all the more critical when we consider what I mentioned at the top of the show when it comes to what's happening in the Pacific Northwest and the kind of heat wave that's going through there. Is like you're talking about 109 degree temperatures in the Pacific Northwest, right? This is the cool Pacific Northwest. I don't mean cool as in hip. I mean cool as in temperature-wise. They are not prepared for this, right? They are not prepared for this. And it's already happening amidst a major drought, right? So you have a major drought. You have high wildfire risk. There's already fires that are beginning to kind of torch up. Right. It's June still. And fire season is starting early again. And this is, I mean, the writing is on the wall, people. The writing is on the wall right now. I mean, if you look at what's like what's happened, I think it's the 11,000, I believe is the number. Let me just double check this real quick. I'm going to get this. Just in Washington State, for example, right, between 2000 and 2018, 800 people were hospitalized due to heat stress because of these increasing these heat waves. It's something like 11,000 people have died since 1979. 11,000 people have died in the U.S. since 1979, and the heat waves are only getting worse, right? This is from BuzzFeed News. So there we have it. So we have an infrastructure bill that is excluding the majority of the climate stuff. And because, look, let's be clear, right? Providing charging stations and having some incentives for electric cars. Yes, that's a positive thing, but that is nowhere near what we need to do. We have to literally at this point, Naomi Klein warned us about this, right? From her book, This Changes Everything, from several years ago. Said, look, the longer we wait, the more that we have to have dramatic measures. And we're at that point. 2018, the International Climate Agency, the working group there for the UN, basically said, we have 10 years. That was 2018. And we just pissed away 3 years. Right? There's no time. So when Biden, and I hope people in his administration and him himself are going to have the backbone to do what needs to be done. And this should be a non-starter. If that climate stuff does not get in, then there's no reason why this should be supported. There has to be a fight. I don't know what else to think. I don't know. We'll see. Look, but I mean, you know, call your representatives. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. You know, this is, you know, look, I'm in the PA first, right? I'm in Bucks County, right? Brian Fitzpatrick is my representative, God help me, right? But he's one, he's come out, he's all, you know, he's, I've been on calls, right? On his like phone call public forums thing and talking about climate change and protecting the environment. This has been one of the ways that he's tried to kind of maintain his kind of bipartisan creds, right? He's a great person to call. Make sure that this is in there. Now, I recognize he's in the House, right? But everybody, call your representatives, call your senators, and tell them this absolutely must be in there. Climate needs to be front and center in the infrastructure bill. And make sure that our senators, well, Toomey's probably a lost cause, but at the very least, Casey is on board with this, right? Call your representatives and kind of put pressure upon them. Let them know that they don't get behind this stuff publicly. They're going to be facing challenges coming forward, right? So finally, on the national wrap-up, have you been following what they're doing in Florida? Have you followed this at all? Look, it's not the first one, but look, you know, this is all the kind of critical race theory hysteria that's going on. But I mean, I literally watched with my mouth agape, if you will, as Governor Ron DeSantis was kind of up there talking about backing this bill. I was like House Bill, I want to say 428 or something like this. This bill that is basically saying, I mean, it's like if you listen to him, it's so freaking full of contradictions, right? He basically claims he wants to protect free speech rights, worrying about kids getting indoctrinated. And yet what he says in the same breath is like, we don't want our kids to learn these other things, right? In other words, he doesn't give a shit about indoctrination. He just wants to be the one who's doing the indoctrination, him and his ilk. And if you sway from that, from his indoctrination, whoo, he wants to smack you down. And so this bill basically says, we find out you're teaching things that we don't like in your schools, your universities, we're going to cut your funds. Right? And teachers can lose their jobs. Right? And they're encouraging students to go record professors to kind of like rat them out, right? This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. The Miami Herald reported like this. This is an op-ed. This is from the Miami Herald editorial board. All right, but here's how they start their piece. The state government wants to know what political ideologies and beliefs university professors hold, and it's giving the green light for students to secretly record lessons to later use what instructors say against them. All of this is being done in the name of free speech. Such twisted logic and targeting academia have been hallmarks of anti-democratic regimes. Now they have also become the Missouri of Florida, or maybe the MO of Florida Republicans, who passed a bill that requires public universities and colleges to survey students, faculty, and staff to ensure, quote, intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity, unquote, on campus. Governor DeSantis signed the legislation into law on Tuesday. Republicans say this is all being done because universities are, quote, socialism factories, unquote. They cannot, however, cite specific cases of what they described as indoctrination by Florida college professors, the Miami Herald reported, and they have been vague in describing a problem they deem serious enough to justify government overreach into classrooms. Don't worry, bill sponsors say. These surveys won't be used against college professors or threaten their employment, even though there's nothing in House Bill 233 that guarantees that, or that survey responses will remain anonymous. University budget cuts might be looming if our supreme leaders or lawmakers don't like what the survey results show, bill sponsor Senator Ray Rodriguez and DeSantis suggested on Tuesday. Right? Although Florida requires consent to record a person's in most cases, students now are allowed to record lectures without consent for educational purposes or to support a civil or criminal case against higher education institution. Right? You can see what this is all about, right? You can see what's going on. And this is classic McCarthyism. I mean, this guy, but you know, look, this DeSantis, he's a more skilled McCarthyite, right? And let's all remember that Governor DeSantis is positioning himself for a potential presidential run down the road. So what we see in Florida, and look, in Pennsylvania, this should be clear. Someone who's been in the state system of higher education and watched for years as Pennsylvania recruited chancellors that came from Florida, right, to bring the Florida model up here, can tell you it is nothing but destruction, right? So there we have it. And you can expect this same, then what's also happening here, this is the point that I want to make here. You follow this law, and I would encourage you to check this out. You know, follow, again, it's HB 233, House Bill 233 in Florida. And you can pretty much count on the fact that we're going to see a bill like this and continue bills like this in Pennsylvania and other states across the country, right? Get ready, everybody, right? And it's not going to be just higher education, I guarantee you. This is going to be going right down to K through 12. We've already seen that happening here in Pennsylvania as it is. So, you know, we're going to squash our kids to be able to kind of delve into history as it is. We're going to erase, right, the consideration of multiple kind of positions and differences, right? We're going to limit what is taught to a bunch of American jingoism, all in the name of freedom of speech. It's like, it really is. It really freaking is Orwellian, I swear to God. Anyways. Well, I'm going to take a quick break. We come back, we're going to talk about a couple things here in Pennsylvania, and then maybe slide into this week's last call. I want to remind you that you can help support this show becoming a patron of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress today. We will be right back after this quick break.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1943. That was the day the Smith-Conley War Labor Disputes Act was passed. In the years before Taft-Hartley, it was considered the foremost slave labor bill. It gave the president the power to seize and operate war industries confronted with strikes or lockouts interfering with war production. It also criminalized any future strikes in seized plants with $5,000 fines and up to a year in prison. And it held unions in war-related industries liable for damages incurred if they failed to give 30-day strike notices. The law was passed just 4 days after miners struck in protest of a War Labor Board decision that denied all of their contract demands. Congress overrode President Roosevelt's veto in passing the act. But critics argued that FDR vetoed the bill over parts that did not go far enough to suppress strikes. President Roosevelt argued for a proposed amendment that would, quote, enable us to induct into military service all persons who engage in strikes, stoppages, or other interruptions of work in plants in possession of the United States. The bill effectively criminalized any worker that dared to defy the wartime no-strike pledge, even as wages and working conditions quickly deteriorated in the face of massive defense industry profits. Miners were outraged by threats of conscription and jail time if they dared to strike. United Mine Worker President John L. Lewis refused to comment on the act, but other United Mine Worker leaders lamented that the bill would hurt AFL and CIO unions. As far as the United Mine Workers were concerned, though, the bill wasn't worth the paper it was written on. The act expired in June of 1947. It was superseded by the detested Taft-Hartley Act.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Whoops, I forgot to turn my mic back on. Welcome back. This is Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. It is Friday, the 25th, and I am here solo. Yes, if you're wondering, if you join the show late, you're wondering where the heck Sean Kitchen is, it's like, you know, who knows? It's the National Lampoon vacation that is kind of extended for week three. And frankly, Frank, I don't know. He might have been a three-week vacation at the get-go. I don't even remember. I thought it was 2 weeks. It's only he's on week three. still in Utah or something like that. So I wish him well. Looks like he's having some awesome thing. I can't wait to see all of his pictures. I don't know if you've been following his lifestyle channel over there on Instagram, but his the pictures that he's taken of some of the places out in Utah have just been extraordinary. Really, look at the Canyonlands. It's been great. So can't wait to see all those pictures flood the interwebs once he gets back and is able to upload a bunch of them. So there you have it. So today's a little closer to home. Just want to highlight a few things that maybe kind of skirt into today, this week's last call, just to kind of keep it a little bit more compact today. There was a huge Supreme Court decision about free speech in the case of high school cheerleader Brandi Levy. I don't know if you kind of followed all this case, but it was actually pretty interesting. We've covered it on the show a little bit before, but basically what happened is that, you know, Brandi Levy, she got kind of pissed off at, you know, her coach or something like this. And then she went to Snapchat and she posted this picture flipping the bird that says F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything. Right. And she did that after she was cut from the varsity team. She was just really pissed off. Right. And she was sanctioned because of that. Right, by the school, right? That was pretty crazy, right? So she got suspended from the team, right, after that Snapchat, and to her credit, and you know, and her parents' credit, or whatever, like she wasn't going to take it sitting down, and so she fought it. And said, "This you cannot suspend me for the team, and that is a, you know, that is a violation of First Amendment speech, violation of kind of like privacy." And she took it to court, and it made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court handed down a decision this way. It was an 8-1 decision, right? You don't get that kind of unanimity in this kind of stuff. The ACLU is producing T-shirts now that just says "F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything." So whatever, pretty cool. And can you guess who the one dissenter was? Clarence Thomas. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So that was fascinating. And he basically, his objection to the case was something along the lines of, she definitely wanted to undermine the authority of the school and say bad things about it. Okay. Thought freedom of speech was an issue, right? Whatever. So that's pretty big deal. That's got far-reaching effects because, you know, you think about this as our kind of networks have extended, especially in the period of COVID, right, where we've seen like, you know, the blurring of the lines between our online personas, right, what we're doing in our kind of the space, the private space of what we think is our private space of our social media channels. And these other spaces, right, you know, there's not these clear lines, right? Social media is on all the time, right? And the fact that they're saying no, she has the right to do that is pretty extraordinary. And I think it's pretty good. I think it's going to be less of an impact, I think, than it would had it been the decision gone the other way. Right? If suddenly we were going to be able to held accountable for all of our social media, right? And that we were going to be able to kind of lose our jobs, get kicked out of school for something we might say kind of online. Right. And before everyone gets, you know, worried, no, I'm not saying that, you know, whatever, you shouldn't tell your kids, like, be careful what you say. Of course you should. But when it comes right down to it is like, does a school district, right, or any public entity for that matter, private entity for that matter, have the right to kind of like sanction you for what you do in your private space? Well, Supreme Court, at least in this case, said no. So that's pretty cool. Now, there's a bunch of stuff, you know, people are kind of like all worried about it because they were hoping the court was going to give these clear guidelines. But, you know, Justice Stephen Breyer, he wrote the majority opinion. He said, look, we can't, I'm paraphrasing here, but we can't basically say here's the line precisely because these, you know, these lines are blurred so much and they're going to continue to change. Right. So. Whatever. So a win. Some are saying that, well, don't put it the capital win on it, put a small W win on it, but still it's a win. And you know, when we had Cory Doctorow on the show talking about internet and privacy rights a couple weeks back, we talked a lot about this stuff, and it's been more and more in the news. We saw the Access Act, which Doctorow talked about kind of extensively on this show. Or the Interchangeability Act, which would basically ensure that, you know, any app would have to kind of be compatible with other ones, so that if you left Facebook, for example, you'd still be able to get your messages from Facebook from a different application. It's fascinating. I have to say, Cory Doctorow's got his own podcast too, as well. It's called the Cory Doctorow Podcast, and he just wrote this kind of like short fiction piece for, of all places, Consumer Reports, about what this Access Act would mean. And he told us, you know, made this little story around it. So if you get a chance, check that out. And about what this Access Act is all about. he reads it on his podcast. So go to Cory Doctorow. His podcast, you go to craphound.com. That's his main website, and you go check him out, and he'll have a link to that there too as well. Good. Look, I kind of promised myself today that I wouldn't spend too much time here, in part because you still got to wrap up things that's going away and all this stuff. But let's just be clear, the assault on voting rights here in Pennsylvania is not going to die down, right? And I got a bit of concern. So let me just say about this. So this is a piece that's come from Penn Live. Said the State House representatives has passed controversial legislation that would overhaul many aspects of how Pennsylvania conducts its elections, including adding early in-person voting and curbside and internet voting for disabled voters. The measure, touted by Republicans as the most comprehensive election security and accountability measure being taken up in the nation today, called the Voting Rights Protection Act, passed by a vote of 110 to 91. Democrats strongly opposed this House Bill 1300, saying provisions such as voter identification requirement and a shorter span to register to vote would lead to fewer people, particularly poor Black and brown voters, from voting. It's now going to go to the Senate for consideration. And earlier Tuesday, the State Government Committee chairman there, Senator David Argall from Schuylkill County, implored his members to start boning up on the House bill so that they're prepared to vote in this legislation in the next few days, and if indeed it's approved by the House. Now, Governor Wolf has already kind of say he's going to veto it, right? He's ready to kind of veto this thing. He said we need to protect our elections more than anything else, right? And he said, look, if you want to, and I'll just read what Wolf said. He said in a tweet, I want election reform too, but House Bill 1300 isn't it. The lawmakers behind this bill are the same ones who asked Congress to throw out PA votes and whose lies directly contributed to the January 6th insurrection. I will veto this bill if it reaches my desk in its current form. So there you have it. Well, let's be clear what's going on here, right? So on one hand, would Republicans in this state hope to pass this stuff, which are going to have the effects? Remember, we talked about this last week too as well. It will have the effect of limiting voting, right? They start from the end goal, right? Basically, how do we limit the number of voters or make it harder for the voters who support Democrats to vote to keep us in power? And then they work backwards from there. So they don't just come right out and say, you know, Black people can't vote, poor people can't vote, college students can't vote. No. What they say is they say, oh, no, we're going to kind of shorten the hours. What does that actually mean in practice? It means that people who work will have less time to vote and will be in more of a conflict with their job. Right? If your transportation is a bus, you are at the mercy of the bus schedule. And if the bus is late, you don't vote. It's like that, right? You wanted the voter ID. We already have. Kadita Kenner said this on the show on Out to Coop Live last Wednesday, right? We already have voter ID. When you go to register to vote, you have to show your ID. Or prove your who you are, right? If you don't have a driver's license, you bring this other kinds of documentation and that kind of stuff. We already got it. When you have to vote, when you vote for the first time at a particular precinct, right? Say you moved, right? You vote there, you have to show your ID. It's already built in this. So what's the reason for this? There's no documented evidence that there's been any voter fraud. Matter of fact, in this last election, I think there was one clear case of voter fraud. I think there might have been two. In both instances, there were people who were trying to vote for Trump. Right? One guy took, you know, his mother died, took her ballot, sent it in for Donald Trump. Right? That happened, what, in Lycoming County? Another one outside Philadelphia? So same thing. For Trump. Trump voters did it. Because Trump told them to vote as much as often as you can. Right? So there you have it. There's no documented cases. Right? And in the rare instance that somebody tries to have like in-person voter fraud, right? Number one, the reason why we don't hear about it a whole lot is because they're caught. Right? It doesn't overwhelm an election. And more often than not, the cases is someone who's just like, who didn't realize. Right? I was like, oh, I didn't know. Right? Whatever. And it's so minuscule. So there's no evidence. There's no crisis. It's just them creating the sense that there's a crisis and using all the dog whistles to let everybody think, all their white constituents, because the Republican Party is a white identity party, let all their constituents think that it's the brown and black people who want to take what's ours, our white society, right? That's what they're doing. So there you go. That's why Wolf's going to veto it. Should be great. Crazy, crazy. Last thing I want to say about what's going on here in Pennsylvania is that 1 week from, well, actually less than a week now, it's on June 30th, you have, if you want to have comments, a public comment about Pashi consolidation plans, well, that deadline is coming up fast. So get on over there. There's a link in the show notes. You can put a consolidation plan to see what goes on. And look, there's organizing that's going on. There's I know that they're up in Lock Haven. They're kind of tearing it up out there. I know Pashi Defenders did a little tour. They went through Mansfield and Lock Haven and Bloomsburg for rallies about against consolidation. There's been massive pushback. Almost all of the contributions to the public testimony thus far have been negative against the consolidation plan, even as Chancellor Greenstein sitting there texting on his phone, a big shitting and grin on his face, right, thinks he's got it all in the bag, you know, so he doesn't need to even pay attention to this. Yeah, there you go. Public dollars going to that guy, right? Anyways, get on over there and make the comments. We're going to have more about this when we get back, and I'm sure there's going to be some pretty significant developments between now and by the time I get back to talk about this live again, so we'll have that. I don't want to take too much time today, so let me just skip right into this week's last call. A couple things. I don't know if you saw this. I just want to close on a maybe positive note, maybe. Is that the – I don't know if you saw this, but the International Space Station this week, they got new solar panels, right? So they got kind of delivered, you know, SpaceX, right, kind of sent the stuff up there. And they had live feeds all throughout the week of, you know, astronauts out there and installing the solar panels, right? And then they have these kind of time elapsed ones, because everything is kind of very slow, right, when you're working in space, of the solar panels rolling out. And it's just something just kind of, it's been this thing has been sitting in my mind for a while this week, and I don't know what it is. And maybe as I was looking, you know, whatever, super moon this week and everything looked was really cool, and I just kept on thinking, like, holy crap. We're at that point, and I, you know, I've been saying this for a while. We're at that point where this kind of like work in space, right, is feeling more normal, right? They're replacing solar panels, right? Just doing routine kind of maintenance, and you get to watch this unfold. They've got a whole system, and it's happening. It was pretty astonishing. So it was like, it's amazing. It's amazing. And this is, you know, again, this is in the wake of, you know, the new space station from China. It's just kind of got operability. There's three astronauts that were launched up to that space station. So now there's two space stations out there. I mean, the Chinese one is, you know, significantly smaller than the ISS at this point. But, you know, everything indicates that they're going to be expanding that. So we shall see. It is a space era indeed. So I'll say. So like I already mentioned, last night was a strawberry moon, which was pretty cool. It's supposed to be pretty clear tonight too as well. The moon should be still pretty big. So you missed it last night. Get on out there kind of like, you know, after, well, probably after 9:30, 10 o'clock or so when the, you know, I guess it depends on where you're at, how flat of a view you got and all that stuff. But so you're out there around as the moon is rising, and it's just, it's amazing kind of coming up there. I wanted to give just kind of a plug for this search engine too as well. I had heard about this a while ago, and I, you know, I just, I don't know why, just didn't pay attention. So it's a, right now it's a, you can get it as an extension for a Chrome browser, for example. And it is a basically an extension that does not collect your personal data, right? And it does not share it, right? And sell it off for a profit. And the guy who runs it, let me see if I can get the guy's name. Guy who runs it is Gabriel Weinberg. Right, let me read you a little bit about him. So the founder, Gabriel Weinberg, started the firm in 2008 with capital raised from the sale of the social media firm that he ran at an MIT student, as he ran as an MIT student. DuckDuckGo has grown to 129 employees, many of them software developers who work remotely, right? And their headquarters is just this little row house size office down on Paoli Pike, a block from the Amtrak and SEPTA station, right? Why is this significant? Well, let me see. Weinberg is a familiar figure. This is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Weinberg is a familiar figure in global internet privacy circles. He has testified in Congress encouraging government officials to break up big tech giants such as Google, Amazon, and Facebook, which Mr. Weinberg and other critics say use market powers to squeeze out competition, right? So they just got a big infusion of cash that came from these, you know, kind of internet folks, right? And they're going to start their own desktop browser. So I started to use it. I wanted to kind of start to kind of see what it was like. And so I used the plugin and kind of I've checked it out. They're a PA-based thing. And they actually have now, okay, we got to put this in context, but they have the second largest number of searches, right, of any search engine other than Google, right? Now, saying that, that seems impressive. But when you realize that Google has dominated about, like, you know, 94-95% of the market, 96% of the market or something like this, then it, you know, you got to put it in context. So let me see if I got the actual number here. Yeah, so here, according to Stats Counter Tracking Service, DuckDuckGo was the number two mobile search engine, also mobile search engine, in the U.S. after Google over a 12-month period that ended in May 31st. It's a distant second place with 2.2% of the U.S. market versus Google's 94%. Right, but that's still millions of searches. So, something worth checking out. I'm gonna check it out. I think I'm gonna reach out to the company just to kind of, like, you know, that'd be kind of a fun interview, cool interview to have, to hear what they're kind of do, and get a sense of kind of who they are. These issues obviously have been more on my mind. You could hear me talking about it today, in part after my interview with Cory Doctorow, and reading more, some stuff that he's written, some other stuff on these privacy bills, and then. I used to jokingly say that, you know, Google is the only empire to which I'll submit, right? Because I really liked a lot of their stuff. But that little quip, right, I don't think is going to cut the mustard anymore. So, you know, so I've been really thinking, and I think, you know, having kids and things like this too, as I'll start thinking about this, having to really think about ways in which I can kind of say protect my data, right? And how can we protect our data? And what kind of policies do we need to enact to ensure that there's options for us to kind of protect our privacy and not just kind of handing over, you know, our data to these, like, these monoliths, right? These are, you know, these monopolies, really. So, so check it out. I mean, it's called DuckDuckGo. You can look it up. If you put it on the Chrome extension, it'll come up as a little extension. And then when you reboot the browser, it'll set automatically as your default. Google tries to kick it out and says, like, hey, look, you want to default back to Google? You say, no, I want to keep DuckDuckGo. And it's worked really good. And the thing that I noticed already, here's the thing that was cool. This is what I wanted to say. So when I was messing around with my searches, my searches come up differently. Right, I did a side-by-side, and when I use DuckDuckGo, right, because it's not wedded to, like, my search history that is accumulated in Google and all that other kind of stuff, I have a different set of search results, and I get to see things that I don't necessarily see when I see that was kind of cool. So I don't know if that'll happen to you too, but if you want it, check it out. Why not? So the last bit of fun for the week is the I mean, if you've been watched the show at all, or listen to the show, listen to this podcast, you know that, you know, I'm a fan of the Majority Report. I listen to the Majority Report kind of, you know, almost every day. I really like the show. Anyways, so, you know, I'll maybe the first to admit, look, I'm not deeply embedded in internet culture, right? In the sense of like, you know, I'm not like the Twitter head like Sean is, right? You know, Sean, you know, lives in Twitter, right? In many ways. And, you know, what happens on Twitter is deeply significant and all that stuff. And I'm not saying that it's not, right? Because it does have a direct impact and influence, but it's also a freaking toxic place too, as well. And frankly, you know, I I've been doing thinking about this kind of stuff. It's like I know I just don't have the freaking time in my day to spend on it, or the things that I'm choosing to spend my day on are not conducive to me spending time on Twitter, right? So that's it. You know, I feel like I'm on more than I should be already, and I to do more is another. But anyways, so but. It, you know, what happens on social media has a significant influence on political discourse, which is why I've got involved with it to begin with. And there's this guy, Steven Crowder, if you don't know him already, but he's like one of these young kind of right wing nut jobs, big pro gun, said all sorts of misogynistic, offensive crap. And, you know, he goes around, he does this, he like goes around college campuses, debates like high school freshmen and just humiliates them. Right. That's his shtick. Right. And like, you know, kind of all these kind of like young white guys who watch his show all the time think that's the greatest thing ever. Right. And he's like, freedom. Well, just when Steven Crowder was starting to get really going, right, on his YouTube channel, he was supposed to go to Politicon, right? Which is like, you know, whatever, a conference for all these politicos. And there was a debate that was going to happen, and they were going to have Steven Crowder and Sam Cedar for the Majority Report. And they were going to go and they're going to have this debate. And then Steven Crowder pulled out. Last minute, like no explanation. The booker from Politicon said she got the sense that he just said he just got cold feet. He got scared. And he stopped returning their phone calls when he's saying, well, because anything else we can do, blah, blah, blah. He didn't even come to the convention. Right. And ever since then. Right. There's been this little kind of thing on the internet, right, around this, you know, little subculture around Majority Report, Sam Cedar and all this, where, you know, people keep on coming out and say, debate Sam Cedar, right? Debate Sam Cedar. And Crowder just will not respond to it. Right. So it's been going on for ages. And so anyways, there's this podcast by this guy, Ethan Klein. It's called the H3 Podcast, mostly kind of like pop culture, sports stuff, things like this. Not a political show, but somehow he got in this back and forth with Steven Crowder. Steven Crowder said, man, I'll debate you, man. Right. And so Ethan Klein tells him, okay, come on, you know, we'll do it. We'll set it up. So this goes down, and there's a lot of backstory to this. You go listen to the Majority Report's take on this, or look at some of the stuff online about it. It's great. Newsweek wrote about it. Forbes magazine wrote about it. A bunch of other publications. But so basically what happened is that Steven Crowder gets on to debate Ethan Klein, and Ethan Klein's basically, look, I'm not a debater. Like, I don't follow politics. Like, it's not my thing. But I have someone here who does. And Sam Cedar was on the Alliance. Sam Cedar comes on. Like, Steven Crowder freaks out, like, oh, it's effing Sam Cedar! And proceeds to be like a child. Right. For the, and it was great because, and Sam Cedar sitting there like, I just want, like, let's have a debate. Let's talk about some issues, blah, blah, blah. And Crowder's like, no, you're a phony. You're a fake. And then he calls him like, what's it with your eyes, man? What's it with your eyes? Your velveteen rabbit eyes. It went off in this weird, weird direction that a lot of people are speculating has kind of anti-Semitic overtones to it and things like this. But I don't know. Cedar doesn't know. But it was watching this guy who has made tons of cash off being a horrible human being, a misogynistic, like, you know, NRA kind of totin', hyper masculine, toxic individual, just got publicly like humiliated. So, for what it's worth, I know I shouldn't take pleasure in this, but there you go. I do. So you check it out. I'll try to have some more links down there in the show notes for today too, as well. But listen, I'm going to cut it off today. I'm cut it off at this point. It's been a good run. I just can't believe what we've done in the month of June. You know, I'm looking back from, we had Colleen Gray Nguyen on. We had Cory Doctorow on. We had Candida Kenner on. We've got the last pre-record, Dana Morrison, Eleni Shermer. We had some great kind of call-in shows this month. We've kind of really, I think, hit the ground running with the Wednesday show with Cyril Mikulenko. It's been something else. It's been a little bit of a whirlwind, especially as school's been ending and everything like this. But, you know, I just really want to, you know, say, you know, thank you to all of you who listen, all of you who support the show, all of you who kind of tweet this out, to share it with your friends, encourage others to become members or become patrons. It's all been amazing, really. It's all been fantastic. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I won't talk to you all before the 4th of July, so have a kind of a happy and safe 4th of July. I got to admit, I'm a little bit nervous about it, given the fact that, you know, the post-Trump stuff and everything and how crazy people have been, but we shall see. I'm going to go off and spend a little time with my family, kind of away from the computer. I have actual physical paper books that I will be reading while I'm there, so I'll be very happy and look forward to it. So anyways, I'll see you on the flip side. We've got lots of content coming to you kind of while we're gone. Appreciate everybody. Remember, if you can help support this show, I could appreciate it. You can just go to patreon.com/rcpress. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. It's appreciated because we can't be here without your support. We can't be part of the fight without your support. Thank you. Have a great couple weeks, and we'll see you on the flip side, everybody. See ya.